From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
J.B. Prisker is scared to face the Irvin-born team. Simple as that. So he's willing to prop up someone he's assessed that will not be able to beat him in the general election, that he knows. Otherwise, why would he be spending tens of millions of dollars to take me down and lift him up if he didn't know that he could beat Darren Bailey in the general? And know that me dealing with him in the general is a losing prospect for him. So he's willing to spend tens of millions of dollars with Democrat in the Republican primary to do that. The first time in the history of our nation that a Democrat has spent this much money in a Republican primary against a candidate. A vote for Darren Bailey is a vote for J.B. Prisker.
That's Richard Irvin. He's a Republican candidate for governor. The primary election season is winding down. Former President Trump is coming to Illinois, but apparently not for Irvin. We'll talk about politics and more coming up on this episode of State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. He's a professor emeritus and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. He's also been a longtime State House reporter and observer. And with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor. Joining us today, Jeremy Gorner, who covers state government and politics for the Chicago Tribune. And Jeremy, glad to have you back with us.
Glad to be here, Sean.
Well, I mentioned first and foremost, Donald Trump is going to be coming to the state just days before the primary. It looks like he's going to be appearing on Saturday, the 25th, at the Adams County Fairgrounds. That's in western Illinois, near Quincy, in a town called Minden. And Hannah, he's coming, but as I mentioned, not for Richard Irvin. Why is he going to be making an appearance?
Well, formally, this is a rally for Mary Miller, who is, of course, the freshman congresswoman who is taking on Rodney Davis in the newly drawn 15th congressional district. She was endorsed by Trump way back on January the 1st. I remember, on the holiday. Darren Bailey had also been hinting for really weeks that he was going for this Trump endorsement. And like I said, this is formally a Mary Miller event, but we have seen Trump do kind of more casual endorsements. He is not a guy who sticks to the script. And so, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if it were turned into a joint, event, because we've seen, in the last week, these, lawn signs pop up that are kind of a triple whammy with Darren Bailey, Mary Miller, and Trump. And Davis last night, issued a statement trying to tout all of his, ties to Trump and his support of the Trump agenda, et cetera. But then trying to say, I would also hope that he's aware of Mary Miller's background, including, keeping a pedophile on campaign payroll.
Now, Jeremy, you've been following this race, and really this, I think to a lot of people, maybe people who don't follow politics that closely, they look at Davis and they look at Miller and they see two people who have both supported Donald Trump at various points, maybe Miller a little bit more. But is this a game changer for this race to have Trump coming in and appearing with her?
Well, certainly Mary Miller thinks so, Sean. She's really been touting this Trump endorsement any chance she gets since January. And the other thing that she's done is in her campaign ads, she repeatedly refers to Rodney as Rodney the Rhino, Republican in name only, basically trying to paint him as a fake conservative. That he's basically doesn't take a strong enough stance on gun rights other traditional conservative values. Whereas, Rodney Davis has basically accused Mary Miller of running a so-called basement campaign where she's really just not out there like he is, with the press and in the public, and that she's, banking, her candidacy too much on this Trump endorsement. And, I will say that there is a sharp contrast between the two. You know, Rodney Davis, you know, at campaign events, he's got the backing of past, you know, Republicans in Congress, as well as, you know, many current and former GOP state lawmakers. And, you know, he's makes himself very, there's just clearly a dichotomy in their style of campaigning. I mean, Rodney Davis makes himself available to the press. He takes questions. And whereas Mary Miller dodges reporters at events, she doesn't even, you know, make reporters aware of when she's having events. We have to find out about them through other means. And then when we show up, she's gets ushered away by staffers. So it's a very different style of campaigning between the two candidates. But what I think you're seeing with Mary Miller is that she's out there though on the campaign trail. You learn about it after the fact on Facebook, where she says she'll be in Quincy or she'll be in Greene County, or you know, she'll be at a Lincoln Day dinner further downstate. We'll learn about that after the fact, but the you know, the point is that she really has put in a lot of stock in this Trump endorsement. And why not? I mean, we're seeing a lot of you know, local races around the country for Trump-backed opponents who are doing fairly well in their primary elections. So she's really, that's, when you talk about working to your strengths, I mean, that's really what she's depending a lot on.
Yeah, Charlie, we've talked over the last few weeks about how Trump is still very still has a lot of popularity among Illinois Republicans. And you've even said a Trump endorsement could go a long way in a Republican primary. Is that your thought here?
Yeah, it still is. And as was mentioned, Rodney Davis is more a traditional Republican. He's more of what used to be the, quote, establishment Republicans. He's tried to position himself very much more to the right, but it would be pretty hard for anybody to get further to the right than Mary Miller. For example, Rodney said that if he is reelected and the Republicans control the U.S. House, he will be the one in heading a committee that will be looking out to have hearings and investigations about what Nancy Pelosi's role was in the uprising on January 6th. What efforts did she make for security? And then he's going to investigate what he calls the sham investigative committee that's going on now. So he's really trying, I think, to position himself as a Trumper. But he still has, in a sense, baggage back when he was a normal Republican. And I think particularly the part of Illinois where Trump is coming is an area that supported him in the election. He did, of all the places that Donald Trump did well, Western Illinois was one of the better ones. And it's interesting because Mendon, which is just north of Quincy, is well away from Rodney Davis's home in Taylorville, but it's further away from where Mary Miller lives over on the east side of the state.
Right.
But they've been gerrymandered, the district has been redrawn to create a Democratic district that would run basically from Champaign through Decatur through Springfield down to the Metro East. And so Rodney's in a district that has a lot of new territory for him. Mary Miller is not even living in the district. You don't have to live in a district to run for Congress. He's attacked her as being a carpetbagger. But if I had a bet on it, I would guess that Mary Miller probably wins the primary.
Jeremy, this is seeming to shape up like a lot of races we're seeing across the country. The establishment Republicans, like Charlie talked about, and basically, we're seeing people who have ties to Donald Trump and maybe the ultra-conservative candidates coming out ahead in a lot of these primary elections. That's what this race is feeling like at this point.
Right. And, you know, Rodney Davis has been around for more than 10 years, right? And he's, it's kind of like Charlie said, you know, he's part of the establishment. He's been around. He's well-known in his district. But I got to say, I mean, I was in Greene County a few weeks ago talking to just a couple of local politicians there. And, you know, one of them basically said that they helped Rodney Davis get elected 10 years ago or so, but that they'd really like to see what Mary Miller has. They'd really like to hear what Mary Miller has to say, because Greene County, of course, is not, you know, traditional territory for Mary Miller's old district. So she's relatively unknown over there, unlike Rodney Davis. However, there's a feeling down there that Davis isn't as conservative as they would like for him to be. You know, they know what Mary Miller's about, obviously, from news stories. I think some of them have probably gone, you know, to other parts of the state to hear her speak. But there's definitely a lot of curiosity about who she is because of her far right stance overall in, you know, positioning in the Republican Party. So I guess my point is that if you look at traditional territories that were once shoo-ins for Rodney Davis, they're not shoo-ins anymore.
You're listening to State Week. I'm Sean Crawford, along with Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and Jeremy Gorner with the Chicago Tribune. Hannah, let's switch back to the governor's race, because a week or so ago, we talked about how Richard Ervin is switching gears himself. He is going to change strategy, focus a little more attention up north where more people are in the state of Illinois. Now, you've been up north a bit, and I don't know, are you noticing any difference in that campaign?
You know, I'm not sure that any of that has broken through to voters, you know, especially because, as we talked about so much on the show, this kind of summer primary is a thing that has not happened in at least my lifetime, probably Jeremy's lifetime. And voters are just generally tuned out during summer. I think that, you know, the hardcore Republican voters, you know, with what we have, like 10 days to go, they've made up their minds, even though, you know, some of the polls that we've seen recently still do have a number of voters who say that they're undecided. You know, I don't think that the Ervin campaign this doesn't give them really time to recalibrate in any meaningful way, especially because voters are just, like I said, so tuned out. The average voter, you know, does not necessarily think of state and congressional races as two distinct things and two distinct ecosystems, even though they are. And unfortunately, you know, that this kind of nationalization, Washingtonization of state politics, one of the things that made the General Assembly unique among legislative bodies in the country is that we have this tradition of moderation in both parties, and former House Speaker Mike Madigan had a lot to do with that, holding the line on his own party, but he also helped contribute to a kind of moderation in the Republican Party to a certain extent. You know, we also had this long tradition in Illinois of these moderate suburban Republican leaders. You know, those who are elected to the legislature are distinctly different from those who are elected to, say, the Republican Party State Central Committee. They just have different incentives. I really have to wonder what happens if Darren Bailey gets the nomination. One, what do these traditional, more moderate Republican leaders do? Do they get behind Bailey? Do they kind of just fade into the background? And then, you know, if they feel very imperiled in their own you know, leadership positions, and here I'm thinking specifically of House Republican Leader Jim Durkin, who among the four leaders has now served longest, like, does he wait for the opportune time to just kind of quietly resign around Christmas time if he feels he's not going to have another term? You know, even though we held off on the Washingtonization of our politics here for a good, you know, decade more than a lot of other state legislatures, it seems that we can't hold it off any longer because the national headwinds are just too strong.
Now, Charlie, what would you agree with that? I mean, it seems to me the Bailey supporters, they want to see that. They want to tear this thing down, and they want the party to more reflect, I should say, them than maybe what it has been in the past.
Yeah, oh, Hannah is totally correct that the Republican Party, the voter base, if you will, has changed dramatically over the years that I've been watching it. And I look back at the Republican governors I covered, Richard Ogilvie, Jim Thompson, Jim Edgar, George Ryan, they probably couldn't survive a primary given the way the base has shifted. On the other hand, because of the fact that the state has become more Democratic, because the Democratic areas are growing in population, the more rural, traditionally Republican areas downstate are losing population, and there's been a dramatic shift. The Republican Party just does not have the same influence that it did have. And so the legislature, in a sense, will continue to function pretty well, but the debates and the discussions are going to be between the more progressive and the more moderate Democrats. And the Republicans will just kind of be observers. We saw that in the last legislative session had a lot of issues. Republicans complained they didn't have any input in the budget. They complained about some of the other issues. And that's fine for their base, but until they can figure out a way to become more relevant, and maybe this fall they will, maybe they'll flip some marginal Democratic seats in the House and Democrats will no longer have a supermajority and they may have to pay attention to Republicans. We'll see. But I would add one other, if you will, cautionary note. This notion that Richard Ervin said earlier, a vote for Darren Bailey is a vote for J.B. Pritzker. And the thought being that if I'm not the nominee, and if Darren Bailey is the nominee, it'll be a cakewalk for Pritzker. Well, 50 years ago, and this is the 50th anniversary of this, there was a general expectation heading into the year that Richard Ogilvie was going to be seriously challenged by the Democratic lieutenant governor who had been elected with him in 1968, a fellow by the name of Paul Simon. And all the pundits thought, oh, Paul Simon, he's going to be really a strong candidate for the Democrats because he had an outstanding record in the legislature and as lieutenant governor. And the conventional wisdom was that Simon could really knock off Ogilvie. And there was talk among Republicans, well, maybe we should cross over and vote in the Democratic primary and vote for this fellow from the North Shore. What's his name? Dan somebody or other? Walker. That's it. Dan Walker. Maybe vote for Dan Walker so he gets the nomination and it'd be easier for Ogilvie. Well, we all know what happened. Walker got the nomination and he beat Ogilvie. So as a sort of a cautionary note about accepting Ervin's premise that Bailey will be a shoe-in for Pritzker, you just never know.
We have about, 10 days, a little bit more than that, before the primary election, so we'll be talking on next week's show as well. But let me save a couple of minutes here for a couple of other issues. And Jeremy, let me go to you on this. There was another COVID outbreak at a veterans home in the state, this one at the Mantino Veterans Home. What do we know about that?
Yeah, Mantino, 16 residents, 6 staff members tested positive for COVID. There was one resident who was already under hospice care who died just hours after testing positive and getting a booster shot. The Department of Veterans Affairs was pretty quick to notify the public about this and said that, you know, all the residents there received 2 doses of the vaccine and 15 are up to date with boosters. And, obviously the Pritzker administration is very sensitive to this, considering what happened at the LaSalle Veterans Home in November 2020. Of course, the Auditor General released a scathing report within the last month or two, criticizing the Pritzker administration, particularly the Department of Public Health, for waiting 11 days to go to the LaSalle Veterans Home. But what happened in Mantino, of course, pales in comparison. What happened at the LaSalle Veterans Home, that was among one of the worst surges of the virus so far. And that was before any vaccines existed. So, you know, aside from the one resident who passed away, you know, the basically what the state wanted to make clear is that state officials were actually on scene within hours of these residents and these staff members testing positive, basically, and, you know, ensuring that, you know, there's, you know, the Veterans Affairs Department was ensuring that, you know, its residents in Manteno at the home there, you know, got tested regularly, were using N95 masks regularly, protective face shields, you know, had enough other PPE equipment like gloves and gowns and so on and so forth. So clearly the Pritzker administration was very sensitive to this and their messaging was a lot more swift after this happened than it has been, you know, from when the pandemic began.
Charlie, just about a minute or so left here. And also news this week that Caterpillar, which had been based in Peoria for decades, of course, moved a few years ago, moved its headquarters, at least, to Chicago. And now Caterpillar says it's going to move the headquarters to Texas. Is this a big deal for the state?
I think it is in a sort of a PR sense. If you look at just the numbers, the employees involved in the headquarters that Caterpillar had up in the Chicago area, up in Deerfield, it's just slightly more than 200. And Caterpillar has more than 17,000 employees across the state at its various manufacturing plants, its foundry, and its labs down in the Peoria area. So you say to yourself, oh, a couple hundred out of 17,000, man, that's nothing. But this is the headquarters. So this comes on the heels of Boeing moving its headquarters to the Washington, D.C. area. Well, in the case of Boeing, the answer was, well, they were just here temporarily anyway. They came, they got some tax benefits that came from Washington State, Seattle, and then they bailed. And they want to be closer to the Pentagon and to Congress, where they do their wheeling and dealing to get into the defense budget. And Caterpillar's chief, their CEO, Jim Umleby, said that it was in the best strategic interest of the company to make the move, which supports Caterpillar's strategy for profitable growth as we help our customers build a better, more sustainable world. Now, speculation was that maybe he just wanted to get down to Texas, where there is no personal income tax, no corporate income tax, and where he could hang out with the people who were more of a conservative mindset than what you find in more liberal Illinois. But as I say, in terms of the actual numbers involved, we'll lose several million dollars probably in income taxes because the CEOs and the other honchos in the headquarters make a lot more than the line worker down in East Peoria. But it is coming on top of Boeing. It is a bad optics for the state, and it gives the Republicans an opportunity to further their argument that J.B. Pritzker is bad for the state's economy, bad for the state's future, because of the fact that he supports workers' rights, largely.
All right, let's go to our notes from the field. Hannah, let's start with you.
In late April, this kind of odd complaint surfaced to the media. It was a complaint filed to the Legislative Inspector General, who's only been on the job for a few months, concerning outgoing State Senator Melinda Bush and former state rep who is running for Bush's seat, Mary Edley Allen. It was a complaint that was circulated in the media by folks who do communications for Representative Sam Yingling, who has been in the House for 10 years and also wants Melinda Bush's seat that she's vacating. The complaint was very complicated and accused both Melinda Bush and Mary Edley Allen of several campaign finance violations, you know, using fake names and, you know, shell organizations and also money laundering. The whole thing was very, you could see that a lot of media outlets did not run with it because it was just too weird and fishy, and like, you know, you would need to run down a lot of facts. And so after, I guess, you know, a month and a half of investigating, the new legislative inspector general issued a kind of highly unusual thing yesterday, in which he said, you know, I feel that further comments by me, you know, after I've cleared Melinda Bush's name are warranted, especially because this was circulated in the media. He says, quote, such conduct appears to have been an attempt to politically weaponize the filing of the complaint as a political action in advance of a proper investigation by this office. Moreover, by publishing and politicizing the complaint in advance of a proper investigation by this office, I find such a conduct to be unfair to the accused, Senator Melinda Bush. This is especially true when the case, when in this case, the allegations made in that complaint turn out to be factually unsupported and unfounded.
Okay, Jeremy.
Yeah, so on the criminal justice front, you know, for years, sexual assault cases have been very difficult for local prosecutors to file charges. Oftentimes you need DNA evidence, oftentimes, you know, just like any crime, any felony crime, you need DNA evidence, you need witnesses. You know, the stronger the evidence, the better for prosecutors. Governor Pritzker on Thursday signed into law a provision in the criminal code that will basically make it easier for victims of sexual assault who've become too intoxicated during their encounters with their attackers to basically bring their cases to police, even if they don't recall consenting to sexual activity. This was a bill that was inspired by a teenage girl from Chicago who was at a party, or she was at a friend's house. She got drunk, and basically a boy that she was seeing at the, who she was seeing at the time took advantage of her. She was sexually assaulted, and she reported it to the police, told them what happened. And basically what the police told her was that there's nothing that they can do. In this case, there was no evidence of force or a threat. She was impaired. She obviously was too impaired to give consent. And there was no evidence that a crime occurred. Well, basically what Pritzker was saying is that in cases like this, it does not matter. Charges can still be brought in these situations, which is, you know, obviously, you know, a big win for sexual assault survivors.
Okay. And Charlie.
Well, last week we talked about how Illinois now has a state rock, Dolomite. Well, we also now have an official state snake. Governor Pritzker signed legislation this week to name the Eastern Milk Snake as our official state snake. And the Eastern Milk Snake lives in, according to the release, lives in fields, woodlands, rocky hills, and river bottoms across Illinois. It has smooth scales, large blotches with brown or black borders, and a Y or V-shaped mark on its head. It's non-poisonous, and some people actually keep them as pets. I'm not sure if I would want an Eastern milk snake as a pet, even though it's the official state snake, but whatever.
All right, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and the Chicago Tribune's Jeremy Gorner. You can get a podcast of our show by going to nprillinois.org, the NPR One app, or through iTunes, and just look for State Week. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.